This is the Podium Finish Live from Austin, Texas, and various points across the country. Here's your host, Rob Tiansen.
And a good day to everyone out there listening to us. Welcome to episode number 103 of TPF Live, the world's fastest hour of racing talk. I'm your host, Rob Tiansen, and I'm so happy you could be joining me for this edition of our show. It is a bit of a solo podcast, or a solo cast, as you kids would say, as Nathan Solomon is off this week. He's at the Superb Owl in Radio Row in Las Vegas, and as a result, I'm by myself, but that's okay. We're going to be just fine on the show. When I say we're, I'm talking about me and you in the audience, of course, but it'll be a good show nevertheless, because on this edition of our post-Busch Light Clash slash pre-Daytona 500 look into the start of the NASCAR Cup Series season, we have a great journalist, a great TV personality, an overall amazing individual in the hot seat this week. That would be, of course, Caitlin Vinci of Fox NASCAR, as she enters her 13th season with the network. And it's incredible how quickly time flies by, because I can remember when she got the great news in 2012 and joined the network in 2012. So I'm excited to have one of my great friends in the hot seat to share her journey with you folks and catch us up as to what she's been up to these last 13 years, if you count 2011, because that's when I met her with her YouTube series, Hot for NASCAR. If you remember that series, bonus points to you folks, because that was an amazing YouTube series, probably one of the first that you have seen where an individual, a journalist, took a content creation route and made it into a vlog or a video blog. So I'm excited for that. You can expect the video version and the article version of Caitlin's story on the podiumfinish.net, and I'm on my official YouTube channel, youtube.com/@RobTiansen, early next week. But for the meantime, I'm happy that you could join me for this show. We have a lot to get to anyways, and we do have a bit of a cameo from Luis Torres, one of our staff assistant editors, as well as staff photographers. Of course, he was at the Busch Light Clash last Saturday. Yes, I said last Saturday, not last Sunday, because NASCAR made the unprecedented decision to move the race up due to the stormy conditions that did occur last Sunday into pretty much all of this week. So we hope you folks in the state of California are okay. Of course, to my sister Luna in San Diego, oh, and my sister-in-law Laura, I hope you guys are okay as well. So thoughts to the folks in the Golden State with what they've been through with the intense weather system, and hope this podcast gives a little bit of brevity as to what's been going on over there. But we'll get to everything that happened this past week at the Busch Light Clash, get some of my thoughts and as well as Luis's thoughts about the race, and also some other happenings that have occurred this week, such as Kyle Larson's test at Phoenix Raceway in his number 17 Arrow McLaren HendrickCars.com IndyCar ride. So that should be pretty cool to talk about that. And also a really amazing radio broadcaster and announcer announced his intentions to retire after a sparkling 36-year career in the radio booth. I'll talk about that individual a little bit later on. But for right now, why don't we hear as the reasons why you should be shopping at SpoilerDieCast.com right now. Hey, racing fans. Are you in the hunt for the latest and greatest in diecast cars? Head on over to SpoilerDieCast.com to get the latest offerings in Lionel Racing, NASCAR collectibles, IndyCar collectibles from Greenlight Collectibles, and much more. If you spend $20 or more in in-stock or pre-order items, you can save 5% off your order and get free shipping with promo code TPF. So head on over to SpoilerDieCast.com, spend $20 or more, and use promo code TPF to get free shipping and 5% off your order. Evan and his team get those orders out fast in lightning speed fashion. A proud sponsor of TPF Live. Yes, indeed, folks. If you use that promo code TPF, you'll save 5% off and get free shipping on your orders of $20 or more. As you know, folks, a lot of those late 2023 season cars are coming in, and then not too long from now, we should see some 2024 diecast cars come in. In fact, Kyle Larson's Hendrick 1100 Coke 600 diecast car is available on spoilerdiecast.com, so place those orders right now and don't miss out on that historical merchandise event you can get ahead of time before the month of May. And I know we'll talk a lot about the month of May as we get closer to that time for the Indianapolis 500 and Coke 600 race weekends, which of course we at the Podium Finish are looking forward to. Now, before we get into Podium Perspectives, I thought I'd give a little shout out to this artist named Wonder, who did this really neat video clip and song with Max McLaughlin, who of course is the son of Mike McLaughlin. And of course, Max is also an esteemed racer who has raced in the ARCA East Division, races on dirt tracks. And this is a really cool clip that you guys can check. I'll put a link to the video on the podcast description. But if you look up youtube.com and search up Wonder and Max McLaughlin, it's super cool that Wonder was able to cook up a single called Time Go in Max's Audi R8. I don't know how he did it, with Max driving rather smoothly and a little bit faster than I would in the car, but it's so neat how he was able to get all of this done with his musical instruments, his vocals, and the audio production tools that he uses to make a song. Because I know people typically want to do songs and they're singing and music playing in a studio, but he did it in an Audi R8. So that was a really interesting and super cool clip to see. I think it's a really neat way to bridge music and racing together, and of course automobiles and performance and speed. So you should definitely check it out. Again, it's an artist named Wonder, W-O-N-D-R, and it's a really cool clip with Max McLaughlin. And I want to give a shout out, of course, also to Katie Kirkwood McLaughlin for sharing that clip with me. I love getting these clips from folks in the racing world, and it is a super cool clip. And if in case Max is listening, hey buddy, stop growing up too fast. How are you going to be 24 years old so soon? I remember when you were just a little kid, and now you're a young man who's racing in professional series, doing a great job, and getting to do a cool song with Wonder. So hope to have Max on this show down the road, but check out that clip on YouTube, folks. It's really awesome. But right now, why don't we get ready to get over to Podium Perspectives, powered by our friends at SpoilerDiecast.com. Now, as I mentioned at the top of the show, NASCAR made a very unprecedented decision to go and move up the Busch Light Clash and the NASCAR Mexico Series races from Sunday to Saturday night. It did come as a bit of a surprise, because traditionally NASCAR tries to make decisions well in advance, and they don't really give a lot of leeway to move events on such short notice. But given the severe weather that was moving into California on Sunday afternoon and Sunday night and pretty much all of this week, NASCAR's hands were pretty much forced into moving this race on Saturday night. Not just for the Busch Light Clash, of course, but for the NASCAR Mexico Series race. Now, this was still a historical weekend, with having the NASCAR Mexico and Cup Series races at the same track on the same evening. So folks, hopefully at the LA Coliseum saw some great racing, or if you were staying at home, we hope you caught those races respectively on FS1 and FS2. Now, before we get to my thoughts about the Busch Light Clash, the NASCAR Mexico Series race, as well as the last second decision by MGK to not perform, why don't we hear from Luis Torres as to what he thought about all that happened at the LA Memorial Coliseum, because he was there. He's a qualified individual when it comes to his perspectives, covering this event for the last 3 years. So Luis, why don't you tell the fans right now what you thought of the Busch Light Clash.
The Busch Light Clash came and went, and honestly, I would applaud NASCAR's decision for moving everything that was supposed to happen on Sunday to Saturday, knowing that you're probably not going to get the race if drivers love it. But deep down inside, do you think it's going to hurt the business of NASCAR in LA? Probably did. Kyle Larson alluded to it. It's going to hurt in the pockets. Danny Hamlin said that no matter what, you were not going to race on Sunday. You're not going to race on Monday. You're probably not going to race at all. So moving it to Saturday was the best decision NASCAR could have done. William Byron alluded to that maybe this could open some new doors for NASCAR as far as potential rain ruining race weekends. Rather than wait and play it out, have a long rain delay and probably red flags left and right on Saturday, let's assure we'll get a race in. But it has to be fleshed out well. NFL has this thing called flex schedules. When you have like 10,000 New York Giants, New York Jets, Denver Broncos games that are going to be so putrid, so bad, that you got to put priority on the Baltimore Ravens, San Francisco 49ers, or the Kansas City Chiefs, because those are the better teams in the league. Whereas those other three teams, like the two New York teams and the Broncos, are terrible. Boot them out. NASCAR is in a very odd spot where you can do that, but it's got to be done with care and knowing that it's just not going to get any better. You cannot just expect, oh, rain is coming, let's move it regardless. And then a day later, it turns out, oh, it's going to be nice and sunny after all. We could actually be patient and wait for it. NASCAR were very proactive about the LA Clash. But there are some consequences that doesn't really matter at the end of the day. But there are people, from an entertainment point of view, are there for the entertainment. That is not just racing. The biggest L of the week is Machine Gun Kelly. I don't care if it's unforeseen circumstances. Sure, not a lot of people showed up at the beginning of the main event because it was just so impromptu, so short notice, and that alludes to what Larson said about the pockets. But the fact that you have people setting up the equipment hours on end only for the start of the green flag, nah, MGK's not coming, let's pack up and go home. Fail. I cannot imagine those people setting up the rig, like all of that for nothing. I feel bad for those people. I could understand whether and wherever the hell MGK resides could have played a big role, but if you're going to go so much trouble to set up something and cannot deliver, they should have not had it in the first place. And I still stand by the end of the day that a certain sister trio would have not canceled. You could pick the one from Mexico, you could pick one from the Valley, you could pick whoever nearby in LA. And I understand with the Grammys, the day later, you really don't have that many options. If I were NASCAR, you put all that effort, I would not bring Machine Gun Kelly back. As a matter of fact, we may not even have a halftime entertainment next year, for all I know. And that is the intrigue of the Clash these days, it's the entertainment aspect and the aura of running inside of a stadium, or in this case, a Coliseum. What does the future hold? Do they go back to Daytona, either configuration? Do they do the short track route like Newsom Myrtle and actually make Speed Weeks mean something, even though when you have the World Series of Asphalt and the dirt racing of Volusia, Speed Weeks is kind of grown outside of Daytona, if you ask me. But if you decide to go to the Clash back in Florida, you run them in New Smyrna, you bring some value not just to the event again, but also bring some eyeballs to stick around and watch the World Series of Asphalt. For your Derek Griffiths, your Steven Nassies, to name a few. More people will be looking at those guys thinking, these guys have potential. And you go back to what Tony Stewart said at Phoenix after Cole Custer won the championship. He's eyed on talent, but as soon as they don't use their heads right or cause some ruckus like the championship race at the Truck Series finale, not interested. This is what guys like Griffith could benefit from if NASCAR comes to the Clash to like New Smyrna, or it could be Slinger or Monroe or wherever. You gotta bring people to not only to watch the main guys in the Cup Series, but also you might see some young drivers like a Luke Fenhouse, for example. That's what the SRX used to mean something. The first year, you had your Ernie Francis shine. You have Luke Fenhouse shine. Look at Fenhouse; he's run some ARCA races, and it's going back to New Smyrna. The modified drivers, like a Sean Bonsignor or a Matt Hirschman. More people stick around to see those races or make those as a prelim event leading up to the Clash. People will look like, I may root for this guy. I might buy the merch. I may track him. I might follow him on social media, what have you. In my opinion, NASCAR's Busch Light Clash should go on the grassroots route. If you want to go back to the Daytona on the Super Speedway on the road course, you got to make it old school. 20 laps, pole winners only. You can have your past Clash winners as well if you must. But I feel like that Haim debut album, the days of the Busch Light Clash in LA is gone, and Mother Nature might have played a big role into it. I applaud NASCAR for being proactive. I don't applaud for MGK just pretty much have all those people set up his equipment all for naught. To me, it's a waste of time doing so. I hope they do get paid, and I hope NASCAR sees this as an unforeseen circumstance into maybe we should have been proactive and maybe talk to the acts and consider the fact that the rain is coming. Do you want to continue? Do you want to do it? If they say no, then announce it in advance. Not in the moment the green flag drops, it's over. At the end of the day, as more people filed up to the stands, it didn't sound like many people really cared about MGK performing anyway, in my opinion. So there you have it. Those are my two cents of how I felt about the Clash and what they should do about it in the future. Till we meet again, back to the panel.
And as you can hear, folks, Luis was pretty passionate about his opinions, even going so far to talking about perhaps this being the last time that the LA Memorial Coliseum will have the Busch Light Clash. Now, I was one of those folks, in my opinion, that I wasn't really too crazy about having this race on a temporary track inside one of the most historical sports venues in the world. But, ironically, Saturday night's race was one of the best Busch Light Clashes I've seen in recent times in any venue that it's been held at. I love the fact that the drivers are a little bit more confident about, you know, how to race each other hard. I saw some passing on the outside groove, which was incredible to see. Drivers taking more chances to restart on the outside line. I also love seeing the aggression for drivers to go and dive bomb each other into turns 1 and 3 on the inside line and taking a chance on that really tricky apron that you probably wouldn't want to touch your wheels on given how slick the track was going to be with the somewhat slick conditions before the rains did approach the racetrack or the sports venue after the NASCAR Mexico Series race. I think Mother Nature was trying to be like, okay, I'll cut you a solid, NASCAR, for doing what you did. Like Louis said, I agree. That was a great move by NASCAR. It's unfortunate because, yes, it did take a bit of a dive on ratings, and NASCAR took a financial hit having to move this race to Saturday night. I don't know if this is something they would be wanting to do for an actual points-paying race, but let's face it. Do people want to have a repeat of what happened to Texas Motor Speedway in November 2020? I think not. That was a really long week for fans, for those covering the event. I know Jerry Jordan of Kicking the Tires was the only individual who could actually cover the race when it finally occurred on Wednesday of that race week, which I thought, man, that's dedication, not just with what happened with COVID, but just to even show up for all of those days. But going back to the LA Clash, it's a shame that, you know, this last, potentially last version happened to be the best one. But I guess as Vanessa Williams would say, I guess you saved the best for last in this case. I love the racing, even if the eventual winner wasn't the most popular driver. He is one of NASCAR's, I should say, infamous villains at this moment. Although Denny Hamlin's father, Dennis Hamlin, wasn't too thrilled about his son basically saying, "I beat your favorite driver." I think he's sick and tired of hearing his son using that somewhat cocky line. And some people may have mentioned on social media, especially with seeing Denny Hamlin on NASCAR Full Speed on Netflix, it's a shame that probably the most personable driver in terms of his personality, his ability to speak his mind, is not a fan favorite. Rather, he's the heel of NASCAR. But we're talking about the race itself. I thought it was great. I'm glad that NASCAR was proactive. I mean, I personally wish they had made the decision to move the race to Saturday on Friday, but I think they were waiting until the very last second to see if the forecast was indeed going to hold true, because weather is so unpredictable. We may have great technology. We may have AI helping us with forecasts and these are brilliant men and women who are able to plot the forecast with their skills in mathematics, with understanding trends and the data that these models provide. But NASCAR had to do what they had to do to make the right call, even if it did hurt their ratings, their financial situation with moving the races to Saturday night. But kudos to everybody at NASCAR, the LA Memorial Coliseum, the drivers and teams for making this happen. I also don't want to sound cocky, but kudos to the press as well. I mean, Luis Torres, I'm glad that, you know, you got to cover this race for a third year in a row. I know sometimes when it comes to weather, you tend to have a really dark view of things, but I'm glad you got to cover this race, and it was a great race, and we hope you folks got to catch our coverage on the podiumfinish.net. We even did a little photo gallery that I think you folks should check out, consisting of Luis's photos and our friend Patrick Vallelie taking some photos from NASCAR Studio that he wanted to share with us as well. So check that article out. There's some great shots of everything that took place on the track and just outside the stadium when the drivers were kind of composing themselves before the storm hit on Saturday night. I mean the stock car storm, not the actual storm that did happen after the NASCAR Mexico Series race, won by Daniel Suarez, by the way. Now for our next topic, I think what we should talk about this. What's the future of the NASCAR Busch Light Clash race? No, we have some different opinions on this. In fact, when Taylor Kitchen was on the show, she raised a really great point. Is it even viable for us to even have the NASCAR Busch Light Clash? Now, I was one of those people who said we should probably just eliminate the race and just have another off-season week so that the fans, the drivers, the teams, everybody in this industry gets a little bit of a breather before we head to Daytona. But for me, I've had some time to think about this. And in my opinion, I think we should go back to Daytona. Now, hear me out. It should just be pole sitters only from the previous season. Then you can have a wild card entry. This wild card entry is not necessarily a fan vote. It could be decided upon a past winner of the Clash that's still active. It could be manufacturer's choice. But this should be a field exclusive to pole sitters only. And it should only be 20 laps. I know folks are saying, well, Rob, when they last had a Busch Light Clash at Daytona International Speedway's familiar Super Speedway layout, Rob, they wrecked all the time. There were so many accidents. Eric Jones's car looked like a jalopy by the end of the race in 2020. But let's keep in mind that the Busch Light Clash's format was pretty long, and there were a lot of cars for this race. I like having Daytona Speed Weeks actually be a two-week affair. I do think it's fair to make it a preview of what to expect for the Daytona 500. And yes, it's deliberate to make it 20 laps because it's 10% of what the scheduled race distance of 200 laps should be the following Sunday. Now, does that mean that the conditions you see in the Busch Light Clash carry over into Sunday's Daytona 500? No, it doesn't, because you could have a really sunny race for the Busch Light Clash, and then on the following Sunday for the Daytona 500, it's overcast, and that means all the handling aspects come into play, and we know how weather sensitive Daytona can be. So for those who are arguing against me and saying, no, I don't want it back in Daytona, do yourselves a favor, watch the past Busch Light Clash races from 1979 to about, I'd say, 1997. I know the cars are different, I know it's going back to the old generation of drivers, but you'll get the idea as to what made this event so special, so unique, and like I said, it was kind of a made-for-TV event, but a good little appetizer before the Daytona 500. So I want to see it back at Daytona, I want to see it the Sunday before the actual 500, and you know what, as a matter of fact, combine that with Daytona 500 front-row qualifying. We're not going to have the ARCA race happen anyways, so give the fans what they want, some cup action. And I want to see some practice come back too at Daytona and Talladega and Atlanta. I know that we're going to risk wrecking cars, but don't we risk wrecking cars anywhere? So that's my thoughts on that. Now moving on to our third topic with Kyle Larson testing on Monday night at Phoenix Raceway, which I guess you could call his hometown track these days. No, he was not testing his cup car, but rather getting some laps in to prepare for his Indianapolis 500 efforts this coming May. Now, of course, Phoenix is a lot smaller than Indianapolis Motor Speedway, but it was a good little reminder of what Kyle can expect in his Arrow McLaren HendrickCars.com entry for the month of May. Now, he did mention he didn't really remember how many laps he ran, but, you know, he did do at least over 40 laps at the track on Monday night with Tony Kanaan on site to be his advisor, his coach, if you will. And it seemed like he is getting more confident, more comfortable in his IndyCar. He still has some concerns about how he's going to handle traffic, how he's going to react to the car's handling conditions, even using the right terminology, because unlike in NASCAR, they say understeer and oversteer. And if you folks at home don't know what that means, I'll kind of go over that really quickly for you. So oversteer, that's NASCAR's way, that's the non-NASCAR way of saying loose, you know, when the car basically is on the edge of control. And understeer, we know in NASCAR that means tight. So he's trying to get used to the lingo that's used in IndyCar, and also getting used to the pit stops, because it's a lot different. He can hit a button and that will lift the car up for his pit crew to service his car a little bit faster than his cup team can do. Although cup pit stops these days, with, you know how it is with the one lug nut situation versus the five lug nuts that we have gone to know until 2022. NASCAR pit stops are pretty darn fast now these days, but I think Kyle will do a pretty good job. I mean, he's got a few more cracks at his IndyCar anyways, because there'll be that open test in April that he can do. And then he'll have the month of May where he's going to have to do a lot of commuting. But if anybody can do it, Kyle Larson's up to the task. Like he said in the press conference and many times to the press, I'm used to driving different kinds of race cars and having to go from point A to point B. So he's no stranger to this, folks. I think he'll be a contender. He's really serious about trying to not only complete all 1,100 miles, but he wants to win both races. So that will be a really fun storyline to watch as we get closer to the month of May. I think the other thing too is NASCAR, you know, they're considering the fact that they may not have him start at the back of the field for missing the driver's meeting, because I know these days it's not online, and if there is any meetings, it's more of a ceremonial thing versus reminding the drivers about the rules, the guidelines, the protocols for the race that's at hand, which will be Charlotte in May. So if he doesn't have to start at the rear of the field and he qualifies really well the night before the 600, and he happens to either win or do very well in Indy, and he gets a good qualifying position, man, he's going to have a great chance to win both races. And whether you're a fan of Kyle Larson or not, if you're a motorsports enthusiast, this is a great story to watch. I, for one, would be really intrigued if he can win both races. And just to see the logistics, the challenges ahead, how he's going to handle all that. So I'm excited for this situation. I'm looking forward to seeing what he can do in his number 17 Arrow McLaren IndyCar, and of course his familiar number 5 HendrickCars.com Chevrolet Camaro. So it's going to be busy times, but he can handle it, and he's still a young driver. He's only 31 years old. Might as well try this while you're young. So he's definitely the best driver to get the double done and perhaps win it all, honestly, since Tony Stewart back in 2001. Not that I'm dismissing Kurt Busch, but Tony Stewart in 2001, I believe he finished 6th in the Indy 500 and he got a 3rd in the Coke 600. Not including the fact that he did spin in the opening laps of the 600. So Kyle is definitely up to the challenge. I just hope the press doesn't regurgitate the concerns that they had with Tony, with Kyle, and saying, is Kyle going to be a danger to his competitors for trying to race 1,100 miles? I think the answer to that question is going to be a big vehement no. So we'll look forward to that. And as we get closer to the month of May, you can expect a lot of coverage of Kyle Larson's Hendrick 1,100 efforts in the coming weeks and months. Now, for our last topic, since we don't have any race to preview per se for Daytona until next week, let's talk about our good friend Doug Rice of PRN Radio. Now, he made the announcement that this will be his last season. He's been in the booth for 36 years, and we owe a lot of thanks to him, a lot of debt of gratitude to this amazing, amazing trailblazer of a great storyteller, classy individual. I mean, whether you're a new person or an experienced journalist, Doug has always got a smile on his face. He's always friendly, always greets you, always chats with you, authentically too. And he's one of the last of the originals, in my opinion, for my generation of the broadcasters, whether on TV or radio. And Doug's voice is a very comforting voice when you hear the races on PRN or NASCAR Sirius XM. It's going to be strange after the season when he's done in the booth. And to my recollection, I believe his last cup race that he'll call will be the Las Vegas race later this year. So it is bittersweet to see him wrap up his legendary career, but Doug will have a great 2024, and he'll have the chance to do something he's never done before. He'll actually get to join the MRN Network broadcast crew for this year's Daytona 500. How neat is that? Because that's something he's always wanted to do, and he deserves it. I think he's one of the best to ever be in the booth and calling races. He's called so many amazing races. I mean, from Jeff Gordon's first ever cup win in 1994 at Charlotte Motor Speedway. Heck, I remember when he called Dale Jr.'s first cup race win ever in his career at Texas Motor Speedway. I remember distinctly because it was a really sad day for me as a Jeff Gordon fan when Jeff wrecked out very early, but I tuned into the race on the radio, just curious to see how things were going to turn out, and Doug did a great job calling that race with Mark Garrow, Brett Rich, I think Brett was there too, of course Steve Richards was there, so many amazing people that were calling that race, and now it's kind of sad knowing that a lot of these people I grew up listening to are not going to be around, but I think Doug has earned this one. He is a three-time NMPA Broadcaster of the Year. He has won the 2022 NMPA Joe Littlejohn Award for his service to the NMPA. He's also the 2020 North Carolina Motorsports Association Jim Hunter Memorial Media Award winner. He's done so much. He's called IROC races, NHRA, IndyCar, Indy Lights, Hooters Pro Cup, Have a Tampa Dirt Racing Series races, the World of Outlaws, ASA, All-Pro Series. And let's not forget, he did do the show Fast Talk on PRN Radio, and I believe that's with the late Benny Parsons. We'll never forget Benny, who is one of my favorite all-time broadcasters, personalities, and racers in NASCAR. It's gonna be a loss for us to know he's not going to be around after the season. So if you're not at the races, or even if you're at the races, fans, and you have a way to listen to the radio, tune it in when you're at a racetrack that's owned by Speedway Motorsports Inc. or SMI. Doug is amazing. I love how he calls races. He's always fair. He's always engaged with the fans. He tells the information without being condescending. He talks to you like you're one of his friends. So here's to a good year for Doug, and I hope to see him at COTA a little bit later this year. Well, what do you think, folks, about Doug Rice's pending retirement or Kyle Larson's test at Phoenix to prepare for the Hendrick 1100 mile challenge, or your thoughts on the Busch Light Clash? Let me know in my social medias on X, Facebook, or Instagram, or even Threads. My handle is at Rob Tionkson, and I will welcome your thoughts. You can also hit me up on those four platforms at the Podium Finish as well. If I happen to hear from you, because you've listened to this podcast and you've given me some great opinions, or you just engage with me about anything that happened this past week, I will send you a diecast car courtesy of our friends at spoilerdiecast.com. That simple, folks. With that, why don't we head on over to our second to last segment of our show, In the Hot Seat with Caitlin Vincey of Fox NASCAR. Welcome back to another edition of In the Hot Seat here on the Podium Finish Live. And of course, for the Podium Finish, I'm Rob Tiongson. And on this edition of In the Hot Seat, let me tell you folks, this one's been a long time overdue. The last time this individual was on In the Hot Seat, we weren't even on the podiumfinish.net. In fact, we were affiliated with a different network, kind of sports network site. And I was still living in Boston. So it's been a long, long time. And this individual has been rocking it. I'm telling you, I'm so proud of her. And people like me are just inspired to keep going because she's just setting her own trail and just kicking that A word I can't say for it because it's a family-run show. But Caitlin Vincey of Fox NASCAR is here. And I'm so happy to have her back. It's been too long. So how have you been doing, my friend?
Well, thanks so much for having me. And I agree, it has been a very long time. So it's great to see you, even though it's through Zoom, still visually seeing you. I appreciate you taking some time to hang out with me today. I'm doing good, just getting set for, of course, another big, busy season. I have my first Race Hub show tonight. So we're back at it, full board, ready for another NASCAR season.
There you go, folks. So after you listen to this podcast, do yourself a favor. Go watch FS1, watch Caitlin, support her. Tell her that I may have sent you, or you, okay. Your future self sent you, right?
Yeah, yeah, whatever. We will take all the viewers as possible. Whoever sends you to come see our shows, we're happy to have you.
Absolutely. And Race Hub's been doing such a great, great job of getting fans informed. And it just recently celebrated its 2500th show, which is crazy. I remembered it when it was just on Speed, and now, of course, it's been FS1, and y'all are doing it, of course, in our late friend's studio, Steve Byrne's studio. So let me just get things started here and get off, get started about your tenure with Fox NASCAR. I mean, I can't believe it's been 13 seasons now. I remembered when you made the announcement on Twitter, you were like, oh my God, I'm going to be joining Fox. And I was like, well, heck yes, this is awesome. I mean, what does it mean to you to be on this journey and knowing that it's been 13 seasons now?
It is hard to believe. You know, I obviously came from the local short track world, working at Langley Speedway for several years, filming reports out of a spare room in my house with a green screen and a camera I set up myself. Just hoping for that big break, just hoping that somebody would, you know, find an opportunity for me. And fortunately, it was the Fox family. And I've been with them since I was 24 years old. And it is wild. This time of year, I always kind of reflect back on that and think about how that all came together and how fortunate I was that someone believed in me, several someones at the company. And it's been an amazing ride. I mean, I've gotten to do a little bit of everything at this point. I've covered every single series that we have within NASCAR. I've covered Supercross, the moto racing also for Fox Sports. It's just been a huge honor to represent that company, to be a face of this sport that I love so much. Every season is different and provides new storylines and exciting things are always happening. So it feels like there's never a dull moment within this career and within this sport specifically. So I'm still 13 years. I still feel every time I pull up to Fox Sports that I'm living my teenage dream. It never feels like going to work. You know, people always say, does it feel like work? It really doesn't. And I think that's the beauty of when you find something that you're truly passionate about or something that you really, really wanted to do. Once you get the opportunity to do it, it's not a job. It's just like an extension of yourself.
And it really is. I mean, I was long enough there to see you doing this on YouTube. In fact, You are a pioneer in that front, if you think about it, Caitlin, because nowadays it's so common. You see a lot of pundits, a lot of young folks doing YouTube clips and trying to be this next media personality, but you were doing this before anyone had a clue about, okay, this is what you say, this is what you do, but you've always carried yourself so well. So, you know, when you think about how you broke the mold in 2011 What was it like to chart out there and just be like, you know what? I've got no precedence. I'm setting the precedence for myself, and who knows what happens in the future?
I'm not sure what exactly crossed my mind and why I initially started doing those home YouTube reports. I do know that at the time, I wasn't sure if we were going to secure sponsorship to do a second year at Langley Speedway with the TV show we were doing there. So I was starting to feel a little panic that there was not going to be any opportunities for me to be talking about racing on camera. And I was like, well, I will just make my own opportunity. I'll just start talking about the sport in front of my own camera to get the repetitions and to get the practice. And what's crazy is that it actually worked. You know, all of a sudden, Scene Daily picked up my YouTube reports, and then my reports are sitting next to Bob Pockris's work on Scene Daily, you know, which I probably didn't deserve to be there. Let's be honest. Bob is Bob Pockris. But, you know, what I was doing was different. It wasn't written journalism. It was just like these sort of simple NASCAR updates on whatever happened in the race over the course of the weekend. So, like you said, social media was just kind of coming along at that time. Twitter was pretty new. Instagram was very much in its infancy stages. Maybe I can't even remember. It might not have even been running yet, but none of that was really a thing. So YouTube obviously had been around for a while, and I saw that as an opportunity to just promote my work, a free way to post videos of myself talking about the sport so people could see my presence, hear my voice, see if I had any actual talent. And so I do always encourage young people to ask me about, you know, what is the first steps? And I think nowadays social media is a great tool. It's a great resource to use to promote yourself, to get your work in front of eyes that wouldn't maybe typically see it. So the landscape has significantly changed on how you can make it in journalism and the different things you can do to get experience and get repetitions. But yeah, it is funny to think back on that time and why I chose that, and maybe being one of the first in the NASCAR space to be doing it, I suppose. I think a lot of people have probably forgotten about it. I think most people associate me with Langley, which was a big part also of my early days, which I'm very proud of because I love the fact that I came from the grassroots racing, much like a racer himself. You know, we kind of all started on that level. I was interviewing Chase Elliott and Bubba Wallace and guys when they were really young, when like Chase Elliott still had braces, you know? So we all kind of just rose through the sport together, myself on the journalism path, them on the competition side. And I think that's really neat. I think I love being able to tell that story of where all of this journey first started out. And then of course, you know, reflecting back on it now, it is pretty surreal to see how it all came together.
It is, because everyone kind of grew up together, as you said, you know, Ryan Blaney, Bubba Wallace, even race at Langley, Chase Elliott with braces, which is, for you folks at home, it's kind of a hard picture to imagine at this point, but
he's 14.
Yeah, it's like, my goodness, that is the passage of time. Does it sometimes make you feel like, can time go a little slower, you know?
Yeah, no, it makes me feel old. You can say it.
I don't want to say that.
No, but like, For Chase Elliott, just remembering when I first met him, and then now he's a champion. I mean, he went on to win a championship in the Cup Series. It's really neat. And I love that I've had a front row seat to a lot of the guys my age, their careers, and watching them grow into the competitors that they are today and seeing everything that they achieve. It's very special. And I think that's what's neat about being a journalist is you're kind of along for the ride with them. You're reporting on the highs, you're reporting on the lows, everything in between. And so there's just this natural connection you feel to the people on the competition side in the sport because you're kind of embedded with all of this with them.
Exactly. I think that is the biggest caveat of all with being in this sport, whether you're in FS1 in Fox Sports or someone like me who's trying to make it still, you get to know these people. They're not competitors. They're not people you've idolized. They're people, you know. It's
exactly it's pretty crazy.
It is, because like for me, I think I'm more happy to see what you've done, because you know, again, you kind of set on this path that was undefined. And like you said, social media is such a wonderful tool. And I think that's the one thing we start to forget, is that people get so immersed on the things we shouldn't get too immersed about, and realize, wait a second, we have the power to affect good changes, good things that goes on. So, I mean, when you talk about good advice for social media, what would you tell like a young blogger or a young YouTube personality, or even someone like me who finally figured out that you should be on YouTube and not just writing words on a computer?
Yeah, I would say start local, you know, go to your local racetracks, see if they have a need for a social media reporter, see if they have a big screen that they use a reporter for. You know, there's so many different types of media jobs out there now. Yes, they may not be at the network level, but they are a good place for you to get repetitions, to gain experience, to get comfortable in front of the camera, to get comfortable with the art of interviewing. And I think too, it's just really look into yourself and ask, what is motivating you to do this? Is it the storytelling and the journalism side? Because for me, that's what it always was. I never looked at this job like, oh, this is something that's going to bring in money or fame or whatever it is. I never thought about any of that. I thought about the storytelling journalism side, which to me is the most important of all. If that is not at the root of why you want to do this, you know, I'm not really sure what the point is, because it's about telling the stories of the people in the industry and being able to create something for your viewers or your listeners that's special. Like, let's be honest, people watch sports to escape from everyday life. They want to watch something that's going to impact their day in a positive manner. So if you can create a feature or a story or a written article that does that, you know, that's achieving something special, in my opinion. So those are the things that definitely motivated me from a young age. They still do to this day. And I think, like I said, just finding those local opportunities, those smaller gigs, whether it's in a digital space, whether it's at a, you know, stadium that you want to work at for some particular sport, they usually hire people to do reporting for their big screens and things like that. So you just have to think outside the box a little bit on different places that you could get a gig, right? And also a huge part of it is networking. Everyone will say that is who you meet along the way that you might impress, who will remember you for something when a job does come up. I think that's one of the most important things, is just kind of carrying yourself in a good way and just letting people know what it is you want to do without being overbearing. And the rest will come together. I've seen it for so many people happen that way.
And it did for you, because I knew back 13 years ago, I was like, she's not going to be on YouTube on her own channel for long. Someone's going to pick her up because she's just too good to be on the sidelines or just doing YouTube. And sure enough, you did. And I know I'm going to keep saying this throughout this interview. I'm so proud of you. It makes me so happy to see what you're achieving and still are achieving to this day. I mean, you talked about it a little bit earlier, how sometimes when you pull into the parking lot of the studios in Charlotte, that it hasn't hit you. It hasn't resonated or sunk in yet. No. But I'm sure at times you're just like, oh my goodness, I know this is what, August, we've been into this racing season for what, not 8 months now, but I'm doing what I get to love. I'm doing what that girl in college in Virginia wanted to do, who was mm-hmm. working so many different jobs. I mean, what do you tell yourself sometimes when it does start to feel like a grind?
You know, like I said, it's been 13 years now, so I know it's a grind. I think it's changed for me now in the sense, because I am a parent and I'm married and I have two very young kids. So the grind when I was a single person, it wasn't as noticeable. Now, because of the family side, you have so many different parts of yourself that you're managing all the time. The logistics, I think, is the hardest part. I just always have to remind myself, like, okay, you know, the certain points in the season when it starts to get hard, plan ahead, make sure you have moments where you can decompress, make sure you have all your childcare lined up, make sure, you know, the different things are set up so that you won't get super overwhelmed. That's the biggest thing that I have to do and to remind myself. And I would say that that has largely changed just due to the fact of being a mom of two, married to a crew chief in the Cup Series who's traveling nonstop. That's the hardest part.
That's the thing. It's amazing. It's like you are able to do all of this while you have your own family. And I know I'm not a parent yet, but I'm an uncle. And I've seen my mom raise me and my sisters. My sister has two kids. I don't know how parents do it. I still think it's the most amazing job, the most amazing role anybody could ever have. And you have a really beautiful family, Caitlin. So, I mean, I love when you share pictures of your kids and you and Blake just having a wonderful life. I mean, how much has your family life changed you, not only professionally but personally, just knowing like how much racing has given to you, even like you said, you're not in it for the gains. You were just doing to tell the to so tell stories, you know?
Yeah, that is an interesting point because I feel like NASCAR has given me all the great things in life. My spouse, my family, my friendships, my career, it's all because of NASCAR, which is pretty wild when I think about it that way. It just the so many pieces of me are tied to a sport. That's why it's not just a sport to me. It's part of my identity. It's part of who I am. And I'm proud of that fact. And it's a really special sport to me because of this. That doesn't mean it isn't hard. You know, I think that people on the outside looking in think, oh my gosh, it's so glamorous. And you're traveling to this race and that race, or you're in this TV studio. And it parts of it is, but it's a lot of work and it's a very long season. And it takes a tremendous amount of dedication in terms of our family from both parties. I mean, my husband, that's not a job, that's a life. When you're a crew chief at a top team like that, it takes a tremendous amount of sacrifice and dedication. So there's people behind the scenes who kind of have to pick up for what he can't physically be around to do. And that is tough, you know, because there's not a lot of couples in the industry where both husband and wife are working, and have high profile jobs in a situation like ours. So I think we've struggled to kind of find what that balance is. We've struggled to find people that we can relate to in that sense as well. So we have our work cut out for us for sure every year. And, you know, like I said, I have young kids, not old kids that can do 90% of things on their own. You know, my son is two. So he relies on me a lot. And that's a hard age and it's a very young age, obviously, super dependent on their parents. So for him and I, it just takes a lot of coordination, a lot of logistics. We have people that help us, obviously we have to. And that's the only way that that can work, really.
It reminds me of an old saying, Caitlin, that it takes a village to make things happen. You know, like you said, you can't do it on your own, and it's good that you have your family, you have your loved ones, you have a support system that helps you be able to live out this dream, this one that it's not just a dream, it's one that really demands the best out of you. You can't give it less than 100%, and if you do not give it 100%, it starts to get to you. But the thing about you, that's why you're a professional. That's why you've been in this for 13 seasons now, and why you're doing such a great job. And the thing I think amazes me too is that you and Blake have these Airbnb B&B rentals, and it's just not like places that people can find. Like, you have your own input that each of you have put into this. Where does all this creativity come from, first of all? Because I'm just like, oh my goodness, that's amazing that you can even have the time to conceptualize this. But, you know, how did this all come about? I'm just kind of curious.
Yeah, so we have some properties in the mountains about 2 hours from here, Lake Lure, Chimney Rock, North Carolina. And we'd always loved the mountains, going hiking with the kids. There's something about the mountains that really calls me and speaks to me. I would rather look at a mountainscape than a beach, honestly. And so we kind of wanted to get a property up there. But then we thought, why don't we monetize it and actually have it as a rental and create something special for other people to enjoy? So that was kind of how we set out to do that. It was after the pandemic, so people were starting to travel again and getting out of their homes and doing things. And we also had a very good friend of ours who was already doing an Airbnb and kind of told us about their process and why they had enjoyed it and sort of turned us on to the idea. And then there was another man who works at Fox Sports in camera operations, who also had one in a different mountain town called Boone, North Carolina. So I hit him up and like sat down with him, talked to him a lot about it, just like different things to keep in mind before we launched one. And he gave me a lot of advice on the process, which was hugely helpful. And so we pulled the trigger and we got the first one. And it was a long process, I will tell you, because the man that moved out of that home left everything there, from his eyeglasses to shoes under the bed to medicine in the cabinet. I mean, it was almost like he just walked out the door, which was a bit unusual because that wasn't really what we had agreed upon. So the first several months was just moving all of his stuff out of the home. Then the renovation process began, which I loved the interior of it because it was a true like log cabin feel, wood interior feel. but I wanted carpets updated, flooring updated, countertops, light fixtures, hardware, appliances. I mean, we did a pretty big rehaul on it. So that took months to do because I'm not sure if you're aware, but people move at a glacial pace in the mountains. There's a reason they call it mountain time. It's slow. It's just like a slower pace of living, and that's fine. But it took a while. So we were able to finally launch it. And I remember when we got that first booking, it was so cool. It's almost like when you make your very first dollar if you've started a business, people always frame their first dollar. It was cool because we're like, all right, we got our first booking, like someone's coming to stay with us. And you know, now we've had, gosh, I think I sent the numbers to Megan, but it's like over 80 some 5-star reviews. We have
Wow.
had 6-time Superhost status through Airbnb, which is, you know, hard to achieve because it's based on certain, you know, qualifications and metrics on 5-star reviews. Just the basically satisfaction level of your stays, your clients, if you will, your renters. So proud of that fact. Proud of the fact it's labeled as a guest favorite up in that area because there is a decent amount of competition up there. And people have gone to our homes to celebrate birthdays, honeymoons, anniversary. They've gone there to mourn a loss. You know, they write all this in our guest book. And once again, it goes back to kind of what I was saying with storytelling, making an impact on other people, giving them something positive, having a positive experience in their life. When everyone went through the pandemic, which was so hard for many people for a lot of reasons, it was neat to create something that allowed families and individuals to make memories and make positive memories. And that has been the best part of all of it. I also love doing all the decorating. I do it all myself. We don't have anybody manage it for us. We truly do all the bookings, all of the correspondence, all of the decorating, the renovating. It's all us. We don't have a management company. We do have a woman who works for us up there that helps clean it and turn the property. Other than that, it's us. Like it's our baby. So it's sometimes stressful, but it's very rewarding.
And I can tell for a fact that it does have your touch on it. It's not like one of those like Magnolia Home stuff that you see from I can't think of her name from like HGTV. I
Yeah.
know it's got your touch, and I can tell you I approve. I think it's awesome.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah, it was so fun to do the designs for them because I would literally draw the rooms out, draw out the floor plans, and start, you know, drawing a placement of different furniture of how I could envision it looking. And that very first one we had some unique spaces that were small and kind of odd shaped that were a little challenging to figure out exactly what type of furniture and what the layout was going to be, how we could best utilize the spaces. But the basement turned out really neat, which was a strange kind of awkward L situation shape that we turned into a vintage NASCAR game room because we wanted something to pay homage to racing, of course, it had to. So that bottom room is really neat. We've had a number of people stay, whether from racing industry friends or people who are race fans, that I think really appreciate that part of the house.
That's more than enough for me to even think about doing this trip one day to go and check it out. And
You
maybe
should.
I'll do my own little YouTube, like this is MTV Crib or FS1
Yeah,
Cribs, you
look
know?
at Chris. You should totally do
And
it.
we'll just put like all obnoxious music and stuff. And now I'm sure
Exactly.
I will definitely have to check it out someday. If there's ever a Mrs. Raw, but that's not
Hi,
why we're
yeah.
here.
Yes.
We'll figure that out at some point. But I also want to talk to you about your book because I don't know how you have the time to do this. It's amazing. And it's not just any book, it's a murder mystery that's like over 300 pages. It's on Amazon, folks, if you want to check it out. I'm amazed that you have this incredible book called Save the Queen City. So I'm just kind of curious again, how did this all come about? Like, how did you find the time to do this? And how much work was put into this? Was this a kind of like a pandemic project you were thinking about, or was this something you did during the racing season? Like, how did it all get together?
So I took fiction writing in college. I would say writing truly was my first love before any of this happened, because when I was a very young kid, I would write short stories for my parents as Christmas gifts. Like, I'm sure they didn't really want these, but for whatever reason, that's what I did. I would give them stories that I had written. And so my parents always said, "You have a very natural ability with writing." And I really enjoyed the fiction writing courses that I took in college. And I told myself someday I will write something, I think. And then it took me 5 years to write Save the Queen City. I had the idea kind of come to me. I loved the thriller genre. It's one of my favorites to read personally. But the main character is a news reporter. So of course I'm drawing from my own experiences working in journalism and her being assigned to a series of murder cases that are happening here in the Queen City of Charlotte, North Carolina. So that was sort of how the story began. But to your point, I mean, it's a long process, especially from the editorial standpoint. It went through major editorial revisions. I had an all women team that helped me on this. From the sort of big edits to changing major portions of the characters and the stories and the flow to the copy editing to the woman who designed the cover with me. It was all females, which is really cool. And I met some great people through that process. But yeah, I am proud of that. I'm proud that I was able to write a story that people have seemingly enjoyed. It ended up becoming a bestseller on Amazon in its genre, which was really neat to see that the day that happened. I'm definitely not ruling out writing another one. I posted recently that I've started a new book, but I am very like preliminary stages on this, so you'll have to stay tuned.
That's so awesome. And I can't imagine the labor of love and work that had to go into it. And you know, Caitlin, as a writer, you have to have thick skin. You can't take it to heart when someone says, you know,
That
this
is
is what I think I would do better here. So I'm
right. Yeah.
sure you had to like, you just had to take it in the chin and be like, hey, they were having my best interests out here. So let's implement that, you know?
Well, yeah, and it's the same working in TV. If you can't take criticism and feedback, don't work in television. Just don't, because you will be critiqued, and that's part of their job is to make us better. And so I welcome criticisms. I ask for it every season, you know, because you can always improve. So fortunately for me, I do have thick skin because of my job in TV, which helped when editors came back and was like, this is, I don't like this. This doesn't make a whole lot of sense. This, you know, scene is pretty weak. You need to improve X. And that's fine. That's how it should be. You know, that's why you have those people there to help make you better. And I definitely feel that in both the TV and the book world.
And that's why you are kicking some major A word I can't say again. But you know where I'm going with this, folks. I think Caitlin's just such an amazing individual. Let's say that. You're just so awesome. And I just love what you're doing. And you're not even done yet with your career. I can't even imagine what the next 13 years are going to look like. So I'm going to put you on the spotlight here and say, if you had the power to time travel, say back to in 2010 when you're still in college in Virginia, what would you tell your younger self about what you're going to experience these next 14 years? And, you know, like what advice would you tell yourself?
I think I got pretty discouraged there for a little while because I was sending out so many resumes. I was going through some pretty big interview processes and I wasn't getting chosen. And that is discouraging because you start to question your abilities, you question your talent level, like, is it me? Why is no one giving me an opportunity? But if you just keep your head down and you keep working hard and you keep finding ways to make yourself different from everybody else doing it, at some point, the right person will give you a yes. And that's exactly what happened for me. And it was very unexpected. I mean, I was, you know, working as a waitress, working at a tanning salon and working at Langley when I got an email from Steve Craddock at Speed Channel and Fox Sports saying, hey, I think I have something for you. And we had been corresponding for years. I would always send him an updated reel, but he just didn't have a job yet. There was no opening. It wasn't necessarily a knock on me. There just was nothing available. And I will remember that day for the rest of my life, along with the day where Scott Ackerson, who was overseeing Speed, called me to say, I'm also going to put you on TV. I still have that voicemail on my phone to this day from 2012 because I will never delete it because it symbolizes the start of my whole life. So it's, I think I would tell myself, just be patient. Don't be frustrated when people say no, because it's going to work out for you eventually because you're you and you don't stop working hard.
That's great advice. And I think anyone out there, whether it's in racing or whatever their passion is, just don't give up. You just have to keep pushing because if you know, you have a chance if you
You
don't give
always
up.
have a chance. It's true.
And
And
that's
sometimes the stars align.
the Oh man, I feel like you talked to me on that one. So that one I'll talk about after this interview. That hit me right here, which is good. Before we wrap up this interview, and I promise this, we're not going to wait another 13 or 12 years until your next interview
Right,
with
I
us, because
know.
way too long. Let me make you feel like you're back in the studio, Steve Byrne Studios. I'm going to put you on the spotlight, pretend I'm one of your co-hosts. So, Caitlin, give me three wild predictions as to who's going to be this year's champions for the NASCAR Cup, Xfinity, and Truck Series. Just blindly picking on these.
Oh gosh. That is tough. Who do I think in the Cup Series? Okay. I would have to say I think William Byron will be a Cup Series champion, just because he obviously made the championship for last year. He was so close to getting it done. I thought he had a breakout campaign. I mean, one of the strongest teams and drivers the entire season. I anticipate that they will pick up pretty much where they left off, and they'll be a force to be reckoned with. William Byron is a tremendous talent. I think that he's got all of the ingredients, from his crew chief Rudy Fugle to the guys on the road crew and the pit crew. It's a really solid group, so I anticipate they will be super strong for a championship in the Cup Series. The Xfinity Series, that's tough. I don't know. Gosh, I'm trying to think who I would choose here for this one. I don't know. I want to say I think Sheldon Creed, and I know the whole departure there at the end of the year from his former team was kind of a lot of people were paying attention to that a little bit. But I covered Sheldon a lot when he was in the Truck Series racing full time, and I always just thought he was kind of that Jimmy Johnson-esque, came from the same background, California kind of kid, West Coast. He had a lot of talent, and I think that he is really going to showcase that in Joe Gibbs Racing Equipment and with that group. Like, he's probably going to really emerge as a super strong contender right out of the gate. He's a family man now, obviously has children, so I think that he could be one of the ones to really watch when it comes to the Xfinity Series. Just too, with the proven success of the Joe Gibbs Racing Camp and their program, I feel like is very strong. He's gonna be in good hands over there to really make an impact. Truck Series, my pick is Christian Eckes. Christian last season had such a good year. It was tough break for him that he didn't make the championship for. I know it was a huge letdown, but he had like some kind of good learning lessons, I felt like, throughout the course of the year, different experiences that were both the highs and lows, which I think those are the things that helps create a true champion when you go through those things. And he is probably going to come out of the gate swinging this season. So Christian Eckes, I'm going to make an early prediction that he makes it all the way to the champ four and is the champion in the Truck Series.
I love it. Those are some solid choices
You
without
were the
even
first
like.
person to ask me all year, so I was like, oh,
Well, surprise. I got you
I'm
right there.
not
I
ready.
was going to say, those are the same picks I had. So I almost felt like you tap into my brain and
That
just
is
kind of.
crazy. Oh,
That
there
is
you
a little
go.
crazy.
All
It
right,
is.
we need to write this down, who we chose,
I.
and then come
Yes.
November, we're going to revisit and be like, oh, we got them all right or wrong.
Hopefully all right, because then we could take it to Atlantic City or Vegas or something. I don't
Exactly.
know. No, I'm having such a great time that you're hanging out with me for in the hot seat, but we're towards the end, unfortunately. But I definitely want to have you back, and like I said, hopefully we get to see each other at the racetrack this year. But before we wrap up this version of In the Hot Seat with you, do you have anything you want to say to the fans? Any shout outs? Anything you want to say at all?
I mean, I would just say thank you to our fans. I feel like we have some of the most passionate fans in all of sports. And there's been a number of them that have kind of stuck with me since the Langley days. And I'm so appreciative of that, of the people who watch our broadcasts, tune into Race Hub, every night for 10 months. There's a very high level of dedication with our fan base. So thanks to them. I hope we do you proud every season with NASCAR on Fox. We sure do enjoy telling the stories and bringing unique content for you guys every year. So appreciate all of those who stay with us throughout the entire season.
And I'm sure those fans are going to get the same love back this year and for the next several years, because y'all are going to be back until at least 2031, which I'm not going to say how old we're going to be. I still
Oh
think we're in our
gosh. Yeah.
mid-20s.
I don't want to think about that.
But I will say this, and I'm not trying to like sound kind of chauvinistic or anything. You're still going to look really great, and I'm
Let's
just going
hope.
to hopefully look somewhat approachable.
Let's hope so. I'm gonna, yeah, we'll see.
Well, everybody, that was Caitlin Vincey here in the hot seat. I'm so glad we had her back. We're going to have her back as much as she wants to be back on here. So maybe we'll do one of these in person, and that will be pretty fascinating, wouldn't you say?
Yes, let me know. So I'd be happy to.
For sure. Caitlin Vincey here in the hot seat, everybody. Hope you enjoyed it. And that was Caitlin Vincey, a Fox NASCAR, Airbnb proprietor, and Amazon bestseller as well, because of course she wrote Save the Queen City, a great mystery thriller novel that I think you folks should read. And if you're into that kind of genre like I am, you know that Caitlin put a lot of TLC into her very first literary novel that I think, yeah, I could see why it's an Amazon bestseller. So my thanks, of course, to Caitlin for stopping by, hanging out with me, she said. For the hot seat segment, and then of course to Fox Sports's Megan Englehart for making that interview possible. As you know, we're getting a lot of the folks from the Fox NASCAR team to stop by in the hot seat to talk about what's going to happen in 2024 and just hear their story about how they got into NASCAR and motorsports media. We often hear from the drivers, but you know, the folks in the media have a lot of great stories to share. So I think you'll like next week's guest as well about what to expect for the Daytona 500. In fact, I think it might be kind of a double header next week. I love to leave you folks in suspense like that. But again, next week, I won't be doing a solo podcast. I'm sure by this point next week, we'll have Nathan Solomon back. I know right now he's enjoying all the great opportunities he's having on Radio Row at Las Vegas for a certain pigskin game that happens on Sunday night. Do I have a prediction about the Super Bowl? There's no betting that I'm doing. I'm not winning anything, but just offhand, I think it's gonna be San Francisco that wins. I'll say 27 to 24. Close game, but I think Brock Purdy, Christian McCaffrey, they'll eke out a victory against Patrick Mahomes, Travis Kelce, and the Kansas City Chiefs on Sunday night, but I could be wrong too. And hopefully it's not the last time that the CBS folks have James Brown, Bill Cowher, Boomer Esiason, and all these great individuals in this NFL Today studios in New York that'll probably travel to Las Vegas for the game. I grew up watching them on TV over the years. It would be kind of sad to see them go, but a lot of young blood over at CBS Sports that I know are willing and ready to take on the next steps. We have Nate Burleson, of course, who's done a great job with them, but I'll give more on my opinions when Nathan's back, because I'm sure he'll have great stories to share about what happened on Radio Row. But I think it's time for us to go and put a bow on our show. So, for Caitlin Vincey, I'm Rob Tiongson. Thank you so much for joining me here on episode 103 of TPF Live, the world's fastest hour of racing talk. For our previous 102 episodes of TPF Live, catch those on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Next week is episode 104. And folks, do you know what that means? Daytona is here. I am super stoked. So, as I always like to say, let's all go get that checkered flag. And until next time, so long, everybody.